This is the Linux Show. It's May, the second week of May. No, yeah, it is. It's the second week of May. It's the 11th. My God, this year is flying away. 2004, bringing you another edition of the weekly Linux Show. We're back. The whole crew's here. Everybody's here. Very exciting. We're going to bring you our regular edition of the Linux Show, and I do have some news before we bring in the panel. For all those people who have been emailing me on a daily basis going, where's the Linux Daily, where's the Linux Daily, the producer is back, and so we're going to start producing segments of the Linux Daily again starting tomorrow. It just took a lot more recovery time than I originally anticipated. I thought I was just going to be without the services of producer for about a week, but it turned into 2 weeks. So we're back. We'll be having the Linux Daily again starting up tomorrow. But let's say hi to the whole panel. Doc, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, and I'm sorry I've missed you guys the last couple of weeks. I was in Europe, and I was on. It just seemed to find myself on the road at the wrong times. In the case of Europe, it wasn't just the road; it was just elsewhere. Well, it would be nice though. Actually, it's like 2 a.m. or something like that in London, where I was at that point. But I had a really good time at. Hanging out with Arnie at the Desktop Linux Summit, where it was very. Did we report on that? I don't know if we did or not.
A little bit.
But anyway, it was cool. It's cool seeing Arnie with even longer hair, looking even more like the grand young man of Linux in Southern California. The interesting thing to me, just in retrospect on that, was how much more a year later the Lindos or Linspire people were really part of the community and very much making themselves part of the community and participating in the community. It was that was actually an issue a year ago, and now it's not even a subject. So that was cool. In Europe, I was over there as a guest of the ICT Expo, which had a subsection or a section that was Linux World Ireland, and the key, the sort of the anchor store for that little ghetto of companies over there was linux.ie, which is the Linux users group for Ireland, essentially. Really great bunch of guys. They were terrific hosts, and I really loved it. I really loved how we managed the Atkins diet over there. When I said that, you know, I hadn't had breakfast or lunch, and I wanted to avoid carbs for dinner, they said, we can go to Costa Street and have ourselves a couple pints. So that was kind of cool. So like that blew up the diet pretty much, and I was there. Anyway, had a great time, and got to see a lot of the cool stuff that was going on there. And in London, I booked it over the weekend in London, and so I saved money for them on airfare by doing that, and got to stay with a friend who lived in the countryside outside London, which I never really hung out in before. It was really nice. And got to walk with his family along the Thames and spend the night there. And I also got to see the inside of the BBC, or at least one of the big production parts of the BBC. He runs a section of it called Digilab, which is really cool. It's a kind of a, there are five people that are sort of revolutionizing the organization from the inside. I shouldn't say revolutionizing, but they're certainly equipping it to do lots of cool conversational things. I saw internal blogs for the first time in a really interesting way, and an internal discussion group. Because I don't live inside a big company, and so I didn't have a chance to see that before. And they've got a mixture of Linux and Windows and Mac boxes on the desktops around there, and they've got a rack that has the same. And one of the insights that I got there was that one of the things that's valued in what I've been calling DIY IT, which I told you last time that I was on the IT Garage, this new site that we've got, is about, is independence. Is independence and choice, and that's really where Linux is taking off in a context of. That's sort of the insight that I got out of that. So anyway, so I've been.
It's a wiki world, isn't it?
It is a wiki wacky world. Yeah, indeed it is. Indeed it is. And desktop Linux, I think. I mean, one of the cool takeaways that I got from almost everybody I spoke to. I mean, Mandrake was a big presence in the at the Linux pavilion, I guess you could call it, at the ITC Expo. And so was SUSE, which is a sponsor of Novell / SUSE. And so, in a way, was Zandros. Zandros is talked about a lot. There's a sense all around right now that we really are on the cusp of it. I mean, just in the last week, we'll probably be talking about this, that we've seen IBM and HP and Red Hat all talking desktop in a serious way, in different ways too, which makes it interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
Yeah, and I got in touch with an old friend, Roland Smith, who I met on one of the Linux Geek Cruises, who gave me some of the really foundational insights that I have used with the writing about DIYT. And he's left LSI Logic, where he's been for years, to go to a new semiconductor company in Pocatello, Idaho. Somewhere in Idaho, I don't know where. But anyway, he said that, he said something that blew my mind. He said that when you can get a Linux desktop at Radio Shack, that's the breakthrough point. Now, of course, it may never be at Radio Shack, but it's the equivalent of Radio Shack. You know, when you walk into CompUSA and turn to that counter on the right where they have all the computer parts, just for example. But he said basically it's when anybody can have a toolbox that is a Linux laptop and do their work with that. That's the point where it really starts getting huge.
Okay, at two stores here in Naperville, suburb of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
Global Computers, which is a computer outlet for the global office company,
mm-hmm.
they do catalog office supply sales and catalog computer parts sales.
Mm-hmm.
They have probably half a dozen major outlet stores around the country.
Wow.
That are basically their catalog distribution centers.
Mm-hmm.
You can now walk in and buy a Linux computer out of Global.
Wow.
You can now, at the CompUSA in Naperville, I don't know if this is true of other CompUSAs, but I go into CompUSA about once every two or three weeks to ask them this question, can I get a computer with Linux on it? As of last week, the answer was yes.
Wow.
Now, they don't keep them in inventory, but they'll have them in 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, CompUSA.
Yep, it's a matter of time.
Yeah. It's the momentum is unstoppable at this point.
That's also the term that that Roland used. He said that it's, you know, I mean, he sounded like the agent talking to Morpheus, you know. This is the sound of inevitability. That's pretty cool.
That's a good phrase. Out of curiosity, seeing as you mentioned the Linux World IE event, the Ireland event, are you thinking about going to the Linux World European Tour this fall?
I don't know. I have a feeling that may or may not, I don't know, may conflict.
It looks like that there's going to be anywhere from four up to as many as five little mini Linux Worlds, just like you went to
mm-hmm.
last week, sprinkled all across the EU over a period of about 4 or 5 weeks.
Wow.
They're starting off in Italy in middle of September. Then they're going to the UK the first day of October. Actually, I think it's October 2nd and 3rd. Then it jumps over to Holland. Then it jumps over to Germany a couple weeks later. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a France event pop up into that mix. Because
mm-hmm.
it makes it really practical for the exhibitors to just pick it up and move it a couple hundred miles and set it down again rather
yeah.
than shipping
yeah.
it all the way back to the United States. It it just is not practical for American companies to go to Europe for a relatively small event when they can do all, you know, they can hit four or five events for almost the same amount of money. It just becomes so practical to do that. We're presently working with the folks at IDG right now on trying to draft up some plans for a Linux World / the Linux Show Road Rally across Europe during that time frame. And hopefully we can get a couple of the major Linux players to step forward and sponsor a series of lead-based events, similar to what you went to last week. But hopefully we'll be having some information on that posted up on the website. But let's go ahead and move around the panel, say hi to everybody else. How are you doing tonight, Arnie?
Oh, doing fine. It's cool down here, and we're waiting for the big Tumblr here at that's been predicted by the name of that professor's name? Supposedly going to get a big earthquake here somewhere before September, and so we're just waiting. Pretty good earthquake weather today, and we're just kind of waiting for it.
So they are seriously predicting the big one?
No, they're predicting a big one. There's lots of big ones. The last big one was the one that was 7.1 out in the desert, and I was in San Diego at my in-laws, and this was way out in the desert, maybe 200 miles away, and the whole place was rocking for about 30 seconds. Could feel it a couple hundred miles away. Pretty neat.
Yeah. Ironically, do you know where the most powerful earthquake to ever hit the United States?
Madrid, Missouri.
That's right. Missouri. Right, yeah. Smack dab in the middle of the country.
Yeah, it's also one of the more dangerous faults, but that's not my fault.
It never is, Ernie.
Ba-dum-bump.
You need the Flonase fault. There's a lot of faults in Los Angeles. You should get one named after yourself.
Yeah, that's the Flonase fault. They've named a medication after me.
There you go.
There you go.
But so, for those people who are nosy about it, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Oh, God. Please stop. Russ, how are you doing tonight?
Okay. I'm in New York on a cell phone, so please excuse the voice quality, but I'm
good.
Here and alive, and of course my timing is impeccable, as I came up by train from Maryland today. Everything was just fine, and not a drop of water to be seen. I stepped out of the out of Penn Station to walk to the hotel, which is only, you know, about 15 blocks away. I get two blocks locked, and suddenly the heavens open. So I got waterlogged within about 30 seconds before I had time to get my my jacket on. So I'm drip drying this evening.
You didn't have the $30 for the two-week cab ride?
Actually, it's not that bad, but the problem is at Penn Station there's too much of a line. So I would have been drenched waiting. I'd rather move, you know. So, but I'm here. I'm alive. I'm wet and talking.
Yeah, it's times like those when I break down and get a limo. Yeah, have to do it.
Yeah, but the thing is that trying to find an untaken cab on 7th Avenue during evening rush hour, good luck. You might as well walk.
Okay, well, things are going well here in Chicago. Kevin, is everything looking good in the network room?
Oh, yeah, it seems to be working reasonably well.
Good. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the first segment. Arnie, I know you've got a bunch of stories up on the list, so why don't we hand it over to you?
First article is very interesting. It's the longest of the articles I cited, and it's called Makers of White Box Supercomputers Hit Their Stride. And this is about California Digital, which is one of these little companies here in California, this one's in California, who are manufacturing and servicing supercomputers that are based on Linux. And they recently sold a supercomputer to Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory called Thunder, which hits, if it would have made the list, it would have hit number 2 on the top 500 list. It 1,024 four-processor Itanium 2 servers, and it turns out 19 point, almost 20 trillion flops.
And why isn't it on the list?
They didn't make the list in time.
Oh, okay.
It will
be on the list.
It would have been on the list, but at number 2, but they didn't make the list. They didn't make the deadline.
Yep.
Well, you know, and they said, what's interesting about this is because there's, like, apparently there's also Linux Networks in Utah and a couple other companies, in addition to the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and a few other places that are doing these Linux clusters. And apparently this has become a fairly lucrative business for those people, and to be have that expertise and be able to do Linux clustering, making some people some good money.
Well, that is exactly why Penguin Computing redefined themselves the way they did about a year ago, with bringing all the clustering talent into Penguin. Because they were anticipating that as the economy did start to come back, that clustering was just going to explode. And it seems that anybody who does have that expertise is making a really good living right at the moment, providing clusters. It seems to be a good business.
Russ, have you had any experience in that kind of thing?
Yeah, you could say so. I'm not going to go into that right this minute. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. The second one, I'm gonna let's see. Let me get to skip a couple of these here. There's one that's not listed, and it's called Yankee Group Report: Bad News, Good News for Linux. And this is citing the Laura Didio report from Yankee Group, which hit last month, that people were fairly outraged about. But one of the things that was interesting here is this is now the good news is that Linux is going, you know, and things are, people are moving from Unix to Linux, and they're making inroads and stuff like that. But the bad news here, and this is something I found interesting, and this is totally unrelated to their predictions, but something I found interesting, peripheral to it. It says experienced certified Linux professionals are in short supply and cost 20 to 30% more than Windows admins with comparable levels of experience. And then it says, and this is something interesting, it could be argued that enterprises are asking the wrong questions. Certifications may not be the issue in the largely volunteer Linux community, but as long as companies want certified professionals, even the most knowledgeable long-time Linux user will not be hired without the paperwork. And I was wondering, exactly how true is that?
I think it's spot on. I think it's absolutely spot on, because I keep hearing people complain in the business world that Linux people are hard to get hold of, and yet I know darn well that there's a lot of people with a lot of talent wandering around out there hoping to find jobs and finding things rather barren at the moment.
Well, I'll tell you what the issue is and why certifications are important. The bottom line is that the first tier of the hiring process in corporate America, and when I say corporate America, I'm including everything from, say, 70 employees and up. So, you know, the majority of businesses that would hire an IT staff. The first tier, their first contact point, is an HR person, not a technical person.
Human resources, yeah.
Right, and so the HR person is expected to weed out the chaff and present one or maybe two thoroughly qualified candidates to the CIO or CTO, whatever the officer's credential is, and that HR person gets their chops busted if they hand off anybody who isn't thoroughly qualified for a job. I know this. I see this kind of stuff happening all the time in the work I've done for larger companies.
And I wonder what this is going to do for certification companies then. I mean,
it seems
to me that the LPI and those people ought to be doing quite well.
Well, why do you think every time there's an event where LPI shows up that the certification tests fill up?
Yep. They were giving them down at Desktop Linux Summit for $25.
Yep. If anybody out there has a Linux user group right now and you contact LPI, I know you can contact Carol Pritchard at LPI, and they will make arrangements. If you've got a sufficient number of people willing to get together and take a test, they will make arrangements to get a tester into your area and set up an exam. They're trying to make this as accommodating as possible at LPI. In fact, I'm looking at the possibility here in the Chicago market of getting together with a couple of lugs and actually sponsoring a testing day. A couple of people from LPI happen to live in St. Louis, so it's a real no-brainer for them to get to Chicago. But they really are trying to make it as seamless as possible, because this is an important issue with HR people. Linux people don't give a damn about certifications, but HR people do, because they don't know enough to make a judgment, and they're not going to risk their job on some guy who says, yeah, I know Linux, you know, upwards and downwards. They're just not going to do it. So, next item.
Now, there's two stories about desktop Linux. So one is called IBM Plans Web-Based Desktop Software from CNET News. And the other one is, could Red Hat mean curtains for Windows? And this one is, I believe, from The Independent, which is a mainstream press in the UK. And what they both mention... a marketing plan that is very similar. IBM is planning to charge customers $2 per user per month for access to their web-based office software, plus $1 per user per month for each IBM application. And they include messaging, document management, etc., that kind of thing. And Red Hat is charging, will provide its software on a subscription basis for $5 a month per person. And I'm wondering, is this a service plan? Is this a licensing plan? What do we got here? And what is going to happen? Where is this going to take software, if it's important?
Well, it's just another model. It's part of the ASP model that was tried during the dot-com era that fell apart because there wasn't enough broadband out there. But it's inevitable that this is going to come back.
I've always thought that a good thing for free software was this kind of a marketing strategy, where you basically, okay, you get to use the software for free, but for a small amount of money, or some maybe a large amount of money, whatever, a regular amount, regularly submitted amount of money, we will take care of your software for you.
Yeah.
And because, in my opinion, I don't think that people buy software. I think people rent software. I mean, no matter whether you buy it from Microsoft or whatever, you're still going to end up upgrading it eventually if you're buying commercial software. In Linux, you're still going to, again, you know, the administration costs of Linux are much higher than the cost of installing it. And everybody focuses on installation, and when maintenance is really the big thing, in my opinion.
Well, I look at this from both sides. I do agree with Eric Raymond's assessment of this kind of a model. I think there's going to be certain businesses that are just not going to take up on it because they like the security issue of having the stuff on a box in their network room. And there are certain companies that are going to be uncomfortable with the ASP type of model, and they're just never going to go along with it. And from a user standpoint, let's look at that $5 a month that Red Hat's talking about. I'll multiply that out. What does that $5 a month come to in a year?
That's $60 a year.
Okay, what does that come to over 3 years?
That's $180 a year. About 3 years.
$180 a year. Okay.
That's not bad.
That's not bad.
How many users you got? 1 million? Hey, that's good money. Like Everett Dirksen, former senator from Illinois, would say, you've got 1 billion here and 1 billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Yep, but it's not bad, but I wouldn't call it a tremendous bargain either. It's certainly something that a business could sustain a model on like Red Hat.
But, you know, also it's a per-user charge.
Yeah.
And per-user per month. And I think what Red Hat is doing and what IBM is doing and what they're both doing is trying to find ways, one, to move people to Linux, and two, to make it easy for people to say yes to it because the costs are so easy to, you know, pretty cheap, inexpensive.
But by the way, I ran into an IBM guy in Ireland who told me that, and I should have, he had a T40 there, and or a T41 ThinkPad laptop, and I said, you know, this button that says Access IBM has to go back to headquarters and get somebody who cares about Linux and not just Windows. And he said, absolutely, they're working on that. And when I asked him with what distro, I told him that I was having SUSE put on my T40. And he said, that's good. So, draw what conclusions you want from that one.
SUSE's a good little, nice little stable distribution, too.
Well, apparently in 9.1 there's a lot more respect in it because of the 2.6 kernel for ACPI and stuff like that. So, you know, suspend and resume, that kind of thing. We'll see.
Yeah, I think you're going to be seeing two definite divergent models coming out of IBM at Linux World this summer.
Mm.
Just based upon the... well, this news that they've been talking about this week and the information that I'm getting out of Dan Fry's crew on the upcoming IBM desktop. So.
Yeah, is this sort of a thin client set for one place and a thick client for the real knowledge workers, basically. Yeah.
So there's definitely a two-pronged strategy coming out of IBM. So, Arnie, we're a little short on time, so I'm going to be moving.
That's fine. You can move on.
Zach, do you have any items for us this week? Or have I completely caught you off guard? Doc?
I'm sorry, what? You're talking to Arnie.
Do you have any...
Somebody at the front door, so I was like distracted. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was asking if you had any items for us this week to discuss.
I think I already got them. I got enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and jump right on over to Russ then. Russ, your story is the week, please.
Okay. We can go through these actually pretty quickly. First one, and the links are all on linkshow.com. One's a piece over at OS News, Miguel DeCasa, the rest of the world, to eventually force U.S. into Linux. And it's actually kind of an interesting little interview, and it's worth reading. But I just want to stay on this theme that's cited here inside the title for a minute. This is one of those things that, you know, Mad Dog Hall, those of us who know Mad Dog well, know that he's been talking about this for a long time, that, you know, whenever someone brings up Linux on the desktop, there always seems to be this chorus of voices that say, that'll never be, Windows is there, Windows forever, rah, rah, rah. Yeah, well, baloney. Mad Dog's take on it is that, even if a quarter billion people in the U.S. have selected Windows, you still have, you know, 4 to 5 billion people other in the world who have yet to make their selection. So we'll see what happens there. More and more I'm beginning to see that's going to be a really important thing here in the next couple of years, because it's rather clear that excitement for Linux on the desktop is growing, particularly overseas, outside of North America. And I think we are going to see the scenario where we're once again, since America as a country did real well in the last round of technology and building infrastructure based on the old technology, is now going to be slow adopting newer technologies. I've talked about this before, and I think it's part of the reason why our wireless sucks so badly in North America, because we did so well with copper that we can't seem to divorce ourselves from wires. And as a result, you know, there are parts of Europe that are literally years ahead of us in wireless technology, and we're not really gaining ground. And I think this is going to be another instance where we may well see this occur, where the rest of the world, which is driven by a number of forces, including the financial aspects of having to pay a Microsoft tax on everything, and the political aspects that you know, a lot of places just don't want to be beholden to an American company for technology. They all play together, and we're going to see a big boom overseas about Linux and the desktop, and we here in the U.S. are going to be playing catch-up ball someday. I think you know, the trick here is to avoid Minitel syndrome, where you know, France actually was ahead of the game when it came to having families online with information services with their system years ago. But then when the internet hit, suddenly when the internet hit, they got leapfrogged. And all the reports I heard was that they had to struggle mightily to catch up, even though they at one point were ahead of the game. So, you know, this is the thing I think that we're going to have to see here. The one good thing I will say is that I am seeing enough buzz coming out of the, particularly the low to mid spectrum business-wise, that there are organizations now really, really considering Linux desktops, and I think that's excellent. But I still think we're probably going to start playing catch-up for the next couple of years.
You know, this doesn't happen very often, Russ, but you know what? I don't agree with you on this one at all.
Okay.
Number one, we know because of the data that there are at least 1.1 million open-source developers in the United States of America. I don't consider the number 1.1 million developers to be catch-up. I think that's a pretty substantial number of developers in the field developing product for major corporations. So I don't know if I agree with you from that standpoint at all. So I don't know if I agree with, well, I should say, I don't agree with Miguel's premise at all, that we're going to be playing catch-up. I think we're going to be just fine. I think that the example also of wireless and broadband internet is a bad example, because this is a very, very specific case where you've got a single industry group that has collectively got their hands into the pockets of our politicians. And they have got, you know, extremely solid monopolies going within the telecommunications industry, and they are doing everything in their power to make sure that wireless grows slowly, that DSL grows slowly, that Wi-Fi grows slowly. They're doing everything in their power to do that specifically so that they can continue to control the telecommunications industry.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah?
Take that last couple paragraphs you just spoke and do a global search and replace on telecommunications monopolies with Redmond-based monopolies, and tell me that it's different. You know, I mean, my thing is that we have another monopolistic force doing the exact same thing when it comes to open source.
I agree with you, but we have a movement within this country already on the state level where they are bringing open source initiatives forward to the state level. Plus the fact that you are seeing solid penetration within places like the Department of Justice and the IRS and the Department of Defense.
Jeff, the courts have always been Unix shops. almost exclusively because of the way they do document processing. And so I'm not really surprised that the Department of Justice would be moving to Linux at all. What's important in what Russ is trying to get at here, and this is something that Doc and I heard over and over again at the Desktop Linux Summit, and that is that the small companies in the small countries are the thing that's going to bring Linux to the desktop. And basically, they're seeing it all over Europe. And now, don't forget, Europe is a little different than the United States. There's economies of scale. All those European countries, the whole of Europe is small compared to the United States.
Yeah, but that's no different from here. Little companies have always, in every industry, been the innovator. That's just the way free markets work. Entrepreneurism always leads.
But it's going to be easier for the small companies to bring things to the larger companies in Europe than in here, where they're a little more conservative and where, you know, there's a lot of space here.
Perhaps, I don't know, with Linux absolutely dominating the embedded space, I don't know.
Well, that's a unique niche.
Well, it's a unique niche, but there are many of them. I mean, look at supercomputers. I mean,
yeah.
There's not much left, but, you know, but...
Yeah, the only thing Microsoft has left is the Office desktop. Okay, that's it. They've run out of other niches. They're getting the crap kicked out of them by the PS2 and the gaming.
And they're getting out of the Wi-Fi business.
So, you know, there's just not much left for Microsoft. So, I recognize that you guys have this opinion, but it doesn't mean I have to agree with you.
I'm not breaking your arm, man.
Spice of life, Jeff. Spice of life.
Yep. Any other stories, Russ?
Yeah, a couple quickies. While we were talking about it, there's a short little piece called Has Linux Finally Arrived over at smallbusinesscomputing.com.
Yeah.
Not very huge, but some interesting little data points in there. Once again, and you know, this has been my emphasis for a long time, if you happen to be in a business situation where you need something to poke under your manager's nose and this fits, give it a whirl. It's a good thing to throw. The other two stories that I have are SCO, and I don't know if you want to handle these separately or not.
Make them quick.
Okay. Basically, two variants of the same theme, and one by Chris Primesberger from NewsForge and all the associated things there at OSDN. The other piece here is our buddy Brian Proffitt over at Linux Today. And both of them are examining the notion of, what's going on with the whole Baystar SCO thing. You know, I think we've gone a little complacent inside the open source world because most people are pretty well satisfied that SCO's got mostly smoke and mirrors. But the interesting points that are brought up in these articles have to do with why is it therefore that Baystar is actually increasing their position, and in particular have said that they're not interested in SCO as a system provider, they're not interested in SCO as a service provider, they are interested in SCO as an intellectual property licensing entity. And that appears to be what's going on is that Baystar would like nothing better than to basically put in a new system of management at SCO that will basically romp around attempting to gather licensing funds in a more clueful way than the current SCO management has done.
Yep.
And from a Linux standpoint, if they actually manage to get some management that's adept in that area, they could go for quite a long time, potentially, buzzing about creating FUD at a time when it would be best for them to roll over and go away. So this is just an interesting notion here. Do we really have to be concerned about what's going on between Baystar and SCO, and could things actually get worse as a result?
They might get worse before they get better. It's theoretically possible. But And the fact is that I'm now totally convinced that the 800-pound gorilla is behind Baystar completely. But I'm also convinced of two other factors. Number one, I am totally convinced because of the evidence that I have personally seen that there is no intellectual property belonging to SCO in the Linux kernel. I'm satisfied of that. And so I'm comfortable competing against the 800-pound gorilla because we've got the 1,600-pound gorilla on our side.
We've got a whole species on our side, which helps. There's a fun story by Roland Smith that he told me yesterday about how their SCO sales guy contacted them and said, listen, I'd like to come down and present you with our case. And he said, oh, good, I haven't heard that. Come on down. And then it developed that they wanted to present them with a description of how LSI logic could comply with the case. And he told them that, well, then you don't have a case, and unwelcomed him to come over. And he said the next you heard from the guy was when the guy called looking for a job. So that says there's not much of a gorilla there, I don't think. I mean, it's pretty...
Yeah.
They laid off the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they are trying to come up with a name change as well.
Oh, really?
I'm suggesting litigators are us.
Good.
So, but...
what do you think?
It's got to be one of those names.
Sco and Fudd?
What?
Combination Sco and Fudd. It's good.
Good,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, Saddam's out of business now, right?
IT Scud. That was
There you go.
There you go.
It's good system.
Okay, well, we're running about 10 minutes behind schedule, so we're going to take a break right now. Kevin, put on a tune, and everybody hang in there. We will be right back with segment number two of The Linux Show. Hang in there, everybody.
We'll be right back. within yourselves will bring all of you to a new understanding and valuing of life, a vision that inspires you to live and love on planet Earth.
And we're back.
It is May the 11th, 2004, and this is the Tuesday night edition of The Linux Show. For those of you who are regulars to The Linux Show, you do know that we promote partners and sponsors from time to time. We're going to give a couple of quickie plugs to some of the people we partner with. One of the things that I want to draw people's attention to is an event that, although we're not going to it, it is what we consider to be a unique opportunity for people to participate in the battle against spam. It is a conference being held in the San Mateo market called Inbox, and you can just go to the website inbox.com and check out the Inbox conference. It's being sponsored by the same guys who put on the ISPCon show, which we go to a lot. So if you're in the market, one of the things that they're trying to do is get people in the Linux community involved. And what they want to do is get people involved on a user group basis. They want the vendors in the ISP / email business to be aware of a lot of the technology being developed in open source. And so they're really trying to get participation in groups like Balug and some of the other major lugs out in California. So check out that. And also, for those of you who may live in the New Orleans market, we are going to be attending a conference that is not open to the general public, but we're going to be attending it. It's called FISPA, F-I-S-P-A. If you happen to own an internet service provider, then you are welcome to sign up and participate. But the reason why I'm mentioning this is that we are going to be, at least I am going to be, in the New Orleans market from next week, the 19th, through the morning of the 23rd. And so if you live in the general area of New Orleans and you want to drop me an email, perhaps we can hook up. I'm going to be going to a couple of different parties the four nights that I am there, but I'll be more than happy to hook up with your user group if you happen to have a meeting scheduled for Wednesday or Thursday night of next week. I'll be happy to stop by your user group if it's anywhere near downtown New Orleans. So email me at jeff@thelinuxshow.com, and I'll be happy to join you. And segment number two, let's go ahead and jump on in. If you are a listener of the Linux Daily, a little over a week ago, we did a segment on the Linux Daily responding to an article that was written at NewsForge by one of our good friends, Joe Barr. And I don't see Joe Barr in the IRC. Let me scroll down a bit. No Warthog. No, Joe Barr is not there. But Joe Barr wrote an article that we responded to a little over a week ago about Red Hat's announcement of a desktop product coming out. And there's a lot of, in my opinion, what I consider to be unfortunate commentary by a lot of the people within the Linux community, because I don't think they really pay enough attention to the verbiage contained in press releases. And the fact of the matter is, and this isn't a phenomenon that Red Hat is the only foil for, this happens to a lot of vendors, is that some people within the community have a tendency of believing that the worst is always going to happen, and that if a vendor makes an announcement about just about anything, that there is some hidden agenda that is out there about their methodology. And a little over a year ago, or I can't remember the exact time frame, but back in the days when the Fedora project was first announced, Red Hat took a lot of flack for, quote unquote, abandoning the desktop market. And we immediately had people from Red Hat on the show to discuss this, and got the answer that Red Hat has no intention of getting out of the desktop business per se, but was going to approach it from an enterprise orientation sometime in the very, very near future. And so it seems to me that a lot of the people that have exclaimed surprise and confusion about the most recent announcement about Red Hat releasing a desktop product are, again, just not paying any attention. And unfortunately, I think this is a case where Joe may have fallen into that category. I think that his, in my opinion, Joe's a great guy, but I think that he jumped before he really researched. And in the spirit of fair play and good community relationships, we invited somebody from Red Hat back on the show tonight. And before I introduce Jeremy, I'll introduce Jeremy in just a second. I want this to be right up front. Red Hat is not a sponsor of the Linux Show. So there's no hidden financial reason whatsoever of us inviting Red Hat to be guest on the show tonight. We think that Red Hat has done a lot of good things for the community historically. No one's perfect. No one is expected to be. Well, that's enough said. On the show tonight, we are having as a guest one of the, I don't know if officers, Jeremy, I don't know if officer is the correct definition, but your title is Community Relations Manager, Senior Community Relations Manager. And what does a Senior Community Relations Manager actually do for a living?
A lot of what I do for a living is what you saw in my response essay to NewsForge. I'm only senior because I'm the only one there and I've been there a while, so I demanded, you know, a title increase. It's not quite officer, but, you know, it'll do for a one-man kind of department. My main job is to make sure that the folks in Red Hat are abreast of the issues within the community, perception about announcements such as the desktop, you know, what is our /.karma, you know, that sort of thing. How are our announcements being twisted, if they're being twisted, how are they being received, if they're being received well, things of that nature.
Well, wouldn't you agree with my assessment that on the whole, not just Red Hat alone, but on the whole, that a lot of Linux vendors have a tendency of getting unfairly judged?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think we're the only. I'll see people defending Red Hat, or rather, in some cases, attacking what they see as flaws in other distributions. Like when somebody will say, "Well, I use Debian," somebody else will come on and say, "Well, you know, I want something that releases more quickly," or things of that nature, or "I don't like, you know, their package manager." And it's kind of an inverse support. It's more like, you know, showing up to a Niners game in a Raiders jacket rather than rooting for the team you're rooting for.
Yeah, I get that. So what exactly is going to be the focus of Red Hat as you move towards releasing a desktop product?
Well, I think we have to start where, you know, the current buzz and hype and business activity already is. I mean, it's been fairly obvious to us over the last couple of years that quote-unquote enterprise buyers are ready to, you know, consume Linux in the capacity that they've consumed Unix in the past. And Linux is getting places where Unix has been, but Microsoft has yet to get. So as you'd imagine, that's, you know, produced an influx of cash that's, you know, resulted in us being profitable. And, if you look back, this is pretty similar to, you know, how Microsoft came at the desktop. They began as an enterprise company, generated a certain amount of steam. Obviously, the PC market wasn't what it was back then, so they didn't have a market to attack. But when the market was created, they were able to use a dominant position elsewhere to move in. And I think we're doing something fairly similar to that. Obviously, there's customers at the other end of the phone that are asking us to do this as well.
So are you... maybe I'm misreading your comment here. Are you already starting to support enterprise clients with desktop services?
Yeah, well, we had folks that were using our WS product in and closer to where we see this desktop role in call centers and browser-based applications and things that they didn't necessarily need your workstation functionality for. They weren't necessarily using it on multiprocessor machines with a lot of RAM and things of that nature. And before we launched the product, we had piloted the code and the associated services with a few customers just to see if this was the sort of thing they were looking for and if we were heading in the right direction. as it progresses, of course, we have to iron out the support infrastructure that goes with that, the unified sign-on and unified directory services, user management, security, and things like that.
While we've got you on the show tonight, I just wanted to tell anybody in the IRC, and Arnie, perhaps you can help me out here, if anybody does want to throw in any questions from the IRC, go right ahead, and Arnie and Kevin will try and pick them up and throw them into the mix. From a standpoint of your company right now, obviously Red Hat has been showing some remarkable not only sales but profitability for the last couple of quarters. Is the hesitance in coming out with a desktop product perhaps earlier or whenever, second quarter of 2003, whatever, has this been primarily been an issue of feeding off of a market so that you do have a controllable, sustainable profit as opposed to just throwing money out into the market and hoping that there's a profit?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when you consider if you go back into the early days of Red Hat, if we walked into some place looking for venture capital and said, we're going after Microsoft, we would get laughed out of the building. And by coming out too early with a desktop, or what we would, you know, call the big D desktop, like big D Democrat versus little D democracy, is that we didn't want to get the focus of, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, as you mentioned earlier in the show, on us and give them somebody to target. I think they've shown a pretty strong history of being able to hone in and target on a particular competitor in the desktop space.
Oh, yeah.
So we were very cognizant of where they were heading, and you can see where they're, you know, where they're trying to get with .NET and the Longhorn, and they had been nipping at the heels of Unix vendors and things and squeezing a little bit into the edge of the network in large enterprises, but had never been able to, you know, really, you know, establish as strong of a foothold as Unix as a technology has. And, you know, Linux bringing the power of Unix to Intel gave us, you know, a pretty good flanking maneuver in that regard. And then as the reference customers built in that space, then all of a sudden the credibility of us as a company and as a brand to be able to deliver a technology, because anybody could announce a technology, as we saw in the, you know, in the bubble days, and not deliver it. So, you know, given the tight wire act that it is to compete with Microsoft directly in their cash cow business, you know, we had to make sure that we were ready financially and the technology was as capable as it could be before we made a maneuver like that.
It has not paid to go up against Microsoft frivolously. I think the case of Windows is a perfect example of a Linux company that just decided to take on Microsoft without really knowing what they were getting themselves in for in the long haul, and they're taking a lot of hits and damage, I believe, because of not thinking out their attacks in the long term.
It makes good short-term press.
Yeah,
you know, that's the stuff that a lot of your media likes to print and likes to hear. And I think that's part of, you know, at the root of why you'll see a negative slant on press releases and product announcements on Red Hat, because it spawns a livelier debate. You know, it's sexier news to say, you know, the other shoe is going to drop, or the Microsoft of Linux and things of that nature. And it draws the eyeballs, and, you know, I think it's not exclusive, like you pointed out, to Red Hat, but to other Linux vendors, but to anybody who's at all noteworthy in a market. It's easy to, you know, to pick on them because, you know, well, they're ahead, they can take it. and things like that. I think that a lot of people who have been watching the community for a while know that that sort of infighting amongst us is kind of contrary to a lot of the ideals of open source and free software, and the, you know, the almost cliche quote of a rising tide raises all ships together. You know, if people are attacking the problem of technology and attacking, you know, a market that, you know, has been overrun by a monopolist, you know, then they start to see that the enemy isn't Red Hat or the enemy isn't Novell. You know, the enemy, I think we all know, in most cases, is in Redmond.
You have some couple questions in the IRC, and I kind of wanted to phrase this so I get them all. Basically, there's a lot of interest in the desktop Linux, of course, in the community. But Red Hat seems to have made a few changes in their philosophy, especially recently. There was a time when you said that you were going to abandon desktop, and, you know, and at least maybe at the home. What exactly are Red Hat's desktop plans at this point? I mean, how did your plans get to this point? I mean, with the changes recently and stuff.
That's a good question. That's one. I think that's at the seed of you know, why Joe Barr came off like he did in the article. Was, you know, not so long ago, our CEO, Matthew Zulick, had an interview and was quoted as talking about the consumer desktop, which reinforced people's opinion that by getting out of retail, we were also getting away from the desktop. I think that's part of the problem that we were having with the retail product is we didn't know exactly who was running it for exactly what. We knew who was calling for support and what sort of support. We knew that big vendors like ISVs like Oracle wanted a slower release date. They wanted a guaranteed amount of time that we were going to support binaries. You know, analysts were looking and saying, you guys are still releasing binaries for, you know, products that are ancient by, you know, Linux standards and things of that nature, and to make everything just a little bit more predictable and more stable. And we're kind of locked into the retail buying cycle. They wanted two boxes a year because that's what we had been giving them and things like that. So when we pull out of retail and then you hear a comment like we're not ready for the consumer market, and, you know, as I say in my article, all of that entails, you know, being able to support, you know, the most fickle, high-touch support market that there is. On the desktop, the home consumer desktop, and, you know, the ecosystem of OEMs and things that are required. That's been our strategy all along. And, you know, some folks in the thread of that article pointed out that our own documentation called Red Hat Linux a fully functional, or called our product a fully functional Red Hat Linux desktop, and that gets back into the semantics of the word, you know, because it was. It was a Red Hat Linux desktop. It wasn't necessarily a run all my games and all my peripherals that I can get, you know, down the street at my local computer shop desktop.
Yeah, well, I think you have hit two very, very key issues. Number one is I don't think it was made clear enough that there's a difference between getting out of the retail business and getting out of the desktop business. I don't think that was ever said enough times. And also, I think the reaction by people in the community of Matthew's comment was, I don't know, it might have been one of those things Matthew wishes he didn't say, but the sorry fact of the matter is he was speaking the truth that Linux in general was, you know, back a year and a quarter ago, was not ready for consumer marketplace. It just wasn't. As offended as the people in the Linux community were at hearing that, it really was the truth. It's a hell of a lot better today than it was 12, 14 months ago, but still, I think Matthew was really unfairly beaten up by stating the simple truth.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's plenty of people who can run it as a home desktop. They, for the same reasons they were able to get on the internet before there was AOL, before they were able to get their own PC, and, you know, they had somebody who was able to help them through the learning curve. When you have to get a company behind that, you know, that's Red Hat's point of view is how can we make a 5-year commitment to supporting this product? All of it entails when you use the desktop word and what somebody's going to think when they see that product is available. They're going to think, wow, a replacement for Windows XP or wow, a replacement for OS X, and it had better be close enough to that experience, or they had better be able to get onto any one of a thousand websites, call for support from your smaller system integrator providers, and have them not say, well, let me go get our Linux guy, and that sort of thing. Then you can start to plan support metrics and all of that. And I think also Microsoft's real cash play in that market is not the desktop and the cost. It's Office and the stack that they have gotten people used to, the applications. I think everybody knows the OEMs don't pay squat for the desktop itself in order to get, the deals that they get, not shipping other operating systems and all that sort of stuff to keep the pricing sweet. That's a tough margin to eat. And when you don't have a lock on the application, or you don't have a suite of killer applications that can displace all that, that makes it worth going through the adoption curve at the consumer level, then you've got to make a business decision to wait, even at the cost of a little bit of negative PR, at the cost of maybe conceding a portion of the market to a competitor.
Jeremy, this also from the RC, and I have my own interpretation of it. There seems to be quite a groundswell in movement to the Linux desktop all of a sudden, and you've had several other companies, specifically Novell, SUSE, making a very, very large plays in that towards that. The goal of a Linux desktop. IBM has been playing with it. Sun has been playing with it. How do you see the competitive environment in the Linux desktop forming the future of this? How prescient are all these movements?
Well, I think they prove demand. I think as you look across all the companies you just named, as scattershot as all of the varying strategies are, I think you'll see that even companies as large as IBM and Sun are still just, poking their sizable toes into the water at this point. But it shows that obviously on the other end they've got customers that are demanding it. They see that there's enough developers to support it. They've got enough in-house expertise. And, we know that having good partner relationships is one of the things that made Microsoft what they are. It's one of the things that makes IBM what they are. And that's the other side of the ecosystem. So I think that for a while, there'll be multiple strategies and multiple offerings. And, the market will probably settle on a few providers, one or two providers, the way they seem to have done on the server side of the space. I don't know that who the other provider will be besides Red Hat, he says with an arrogant tone in his voice. but I think we can see that all of the various models are being tested.
And Novell and Novell is certainly a brand new player in the Linux market, but they seem to be really coming on the strongest in this area.
Absolutely. I think, and that's the sort of thing that you look for as far as, a really market disruptor, somebody who has got a credible enough stake in the business making a dramatic move in that direction. The same thing could happen if an IHV decided we're going to support a desktop Linux of their choice across all laptops and across all home desktops. Then all of a sudden their competitors would have to take notice. So I think you see that Novell is in this space, and they've got old enemies at Microsoft, and certainly it didn't slip our radar, that Novell, a highly recognizable brand with a large channel and a good number of employees, had bought our largest competitor, as well as a desktop company.
And how do you see this as a door opening for Red Hat then?
Well, I think the market can withstand the multiple vendors. I think that part of the reason you see so much negativism toward any Linux company that has an announcement from its detractors is because the world is letting us know that they won't tolerate another single provider environment. And I think we've gotten to the point where PCs are pervasive enough, devices are pervasive enough, people can switch cell phones and PDAs without, you know, worrying about, you know, little things like the icons don't look the same. So you don't need a de facto standard to kind of settle the market. So I think there can be space for Novell, there can be space for Red Hat, and I think, you know, a few others. I think Microsoft's chunk of the pie is only, you know, the tip of the iceberg when you consider what the potential global PC market is.
Yeah, actually, I think ironically, a you know, mission-critical killer app like OpenOffice is actually extremely good for a company like Red Hat, because you've got a piece of Office software that is totally agnostic about not only what operating system it's going to play on, but in the terms of Linux distribution, it's flying on all of them. So it really does put a distro company, companies like yours and like SUSE and like Mandrake, it puts you into the competitive space of really being able to focus in on product that an identifiable niche demands. And certainly some of you are going to cross-cover the same exact enterprise clientele, but I'm sure there's going to also be enough differentiation where people are going to have choices. And I think that it's going to be very, very interesting to see how this dynamics all plays out over the next year or two.
And I think if you add into that things like Mozilla and Firebird and other, you know, killer apps, Evolution being developed,
Evolution,
you know,
yeah,
by, you know, by competitors and, you know, other Linux companies than Novell are going to be able to ship Evolution, and it really changes the dynamics of the market and moves the commodity aspect of IT, you know, up a layer into the software and at least into the client applications. And, you know, so the way you do business doesn't have to be that you lock people in.
And into support as well.
Sure.
As a differentiation.
Well, and it keeps all of these companies honest, because if I've got users who are all used to OpenOffice and they're all used to Mozilla and they're all used to Game and Evolution, I can migrate the operating system and they don't care.
Yep.
And when you're talking something like Linux and the number of architectures that it supports, then you don't care about the hardware either.
Very interesting indeed. Well, I want to thank you, Jeremy, for stopping by. We are up to almost quarter after the hour, and we're going to call it an evening. But if you do me a favor, hang around for a minute or two after the sign-off, because I'd like to talk you off the air for a moment,
okay,
if we could.
Sure.
But thank you for coming by, and I just want you to know, as the community representative, you are welcome on the Linux show any old time you want.
Okay? Awesome. Does that mean I can come over when you guys are broadcasting from Linux World?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cool.
No question about it. And in fact, we'll if you'll drop me an email to remind me a couple of weeks ahead of the show, I'll make sure that we do some kind of a party event around you.
Cool.
We'll throw swag to the peon.
Nice.
Or something like that. But no, the shows are always open to people like Red Hat. Red Hat is certainly, a very, very short list of companies that have paid their dues in spades. And as one of the many voices of the Linux community, you certainly are entitled to make use of the Linux show when you wish. So whenever you feel that you need to address the community, just drop us an email.
Will do.
The platform is yours.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
No problem at all. So on behalf of the whole crew here at the Linux Show, I'd like to thank everybody for stopping by. Make sure you come back next week on the 18th. We'll be doing a short show next Tuesday night because I need to pack up and leave for New Orleans on Tuesday night. So everybody, check us out next week, Tuesday the 18th. We'll be back then. Good night, everybody.
I'm going to go to the hospital.